welcome to the KMXT Weekly Wrap, where we go over this week's news from Alaska's Emerald Isle. I'm your host, Davis Hovey. On this week's recap, the Kodiak Island Borough School District's Board of Education is waiting at least another week before it decides how it will cover a looming budget deficit for next school year.
Kodiak and all of Alaska is facing enrollment decline and long-term funding challenges. Acting as though we can shield one subset of families from that reality while everyone else bears the burden is neither equitable nor honest.
More about that story later, but first...
Support for KMXT comes from the Kodiak Area Native Association's Substance Use Treatment Team. Talk with your kids about drugs and tobacco. No matter how young children are, talking with them is one of the best things you can do to keep them drug and tobacco free. Learn more at KodiakHealthcare.org or 907-486-7380.
Our first two stories this week come from our colleagues at Alaska Public Media. Finding quality fruits and vegetables in Alaska can be a real challenge, especially during the winter, and that's particularly true in rural parts of the state. But for the last few months, Alaska Commercial Company, also known as AC, has been working to change that by flying goods to three Western Alaska communities. As Alaska Public Media's Ava White reports, the company thinks it's a win-win.
It used to take about a week. Kyle Hill, president of AC, says the goal is to dramatically reduce that time.
It's getting produce as quickly as possible, as fresh as possible to regions outside of Anchorage, ideally next day from Seattle to the AC store.
The retail chain operates nearly 40 stores in rural Alaska. The company launched the new program in October, and it's being tested at AC stores in Nome, Dillingham, and King Salmon. The company declined to give specific figures on how much the program costs, but Hill says it largely pencils out. He says flying up fruits and veggies is much more expensive than barging them, but fresher produce means more sales and a lot less waste.
The offsetting factor there is we're not making more money on this, but we're not losing money on it. But if we're saving similar dollars on what we call shrink, which is a product that either spoils or doesn't sell and you need to dispose of it, then the program works.
The company partners with Northern Air Cargo for the deliveries. They are supposed to arrive in the communities the next day a few times a week. But winter freight logistics in Alaska are challenging. And Hill says that during the program's first few months, that target has been met about 65% of the time.
We've had in some cases 2-, 3-, 4-day delays. But it's still faster than it would have been if we would have put the berries or the bananas or the bag salads on a container ship from Seattle to Anchorage.
Hill says produce is as fresh as what consumers can buy in Anchorage. Shipments include everything from bananas and berries to zucchini and packaged salad. And rural residents are noticing an improvement in produce quality. We caught Ashley Davis at the AC in Dillingham on a recent Friday when she was shopping for green peppers.
We almost never have them, and there's lots of peppers in stock and vegetables, which is great, especially at the start of a year when people are trying to eat healthy. It's really nice to have the option of picking up stuff here fresh.
Davis says having access to fresh foods is something she was worried about when she moved to the Bristol Bay town from Atlanta 3 years ago. About 70 miles away in King Salmon, Lisa Anderson says fresh vegetables and fruits used to be few and far between. Now, it's the opposite.
When I go to Anchorage to see anybody, I'd always walk through the produce store just in awe. So, and that's what it looks like when you go down and see them now here. It has just been phenomenal.
The majority of food Alaskans eat is imported, and access to fresh, affordable food is a struggle across the state. Last year, Mike Jones, an economist with the University of Alaska Anchorage's Institute of Social and Economic Research, looked at how transportation issues impact food quality and availability in rural Alaska. He found that spoilage rates are generally higher across the board in winter compared to summer, and the main culprits are time and temperature.
For things like salad vegetables, we're seeing up to 30% spoil in transit. What really surprised me is you see about 1 in 7 potatoes even get thrown away in the winter when they get to a certain village grocery store.
Jones says he's excited to see how the new AC program plays out. For it to be successful, he says it's crucial that these items get moved off the tarmac quickly because freezing can be extremely damaging to fruits and veggies. The program is complex and involves lots of moving parts, but Hill, the president of Alaska Commercial Co., says the company is committed.
We are so focused on fresh, healthy, nutritious food because for a very long time it's been hard to get that in rural Alaska, that we're going to make this work one way or another.
The company hopes to make the program permanent and expand it to more communities across the state. With help from Margaret Sutherland in Dillingham, I'm Ava White in Anchorage.
The Alaska House of Representatives passed a bill on Friday, January 30th, that would tighten residency requirements for Alaskans buying hunting or fishing licenses. Alaska Public Media reports, House Bill 93 aims to ensure that only people who spend enough time each year in Alaska to qualify for a permanent fund dividend can also buy resident licenses. Those tend to cost less money and offer higher bag limits than non-resident licenses. State law currently limits resident licenses to people who are physically present in Alaska with no plans to leave, do not claim residency in another state, and have maintained a home in the state for 12 consecutive months. But it does not require that resident hunters actually live in the state for a full year. Representative Rebecca Hemshute, a Sitka independent who sponsored the bill, says that definition leaves a big loophole.
The last point means that we allow someone who rents a room in a home from friends, or someone who has a liveaboard boat that's on a trailer, but actually is in the state for less than a month, less than 2 months, potentially less than a week, to hunt and fish and enjoy the higher bag limits that are reserved for residents who are here year-round, shoveling snow, volunteering in their communities, and putting their kids in our schools.
Hemshute's bill seeks to close that loophole. Alaskans would have to be physically present in the state for at least 180 days each year to get resident licenses. There would still be numerous exemptions, including for military service members, students, and others allowed to be outside the state and are still eligible for permanent fund dividends. People who do not qualify for a resident license would have the option to buy a non-resident license instead. A wide range of Fish and Game advisory committees, tribes, and local governments spread across the state backed the bill. Some 12 House Republicans opposed the bill, including Big Lake Republican Representative Kevin McCabe. He says he's concerned the bill would exclude some Alaskans from the benefits of a resident license.
What about those pilots that have vacation homes elsewhere that would like to go spend 2 months in Hawaii, say, and then they have to fly out of state for 15 days a month?
Still, the bill had broad support and passed with a bipartisan two-thirds majority in favor. Here's Representative Dan Sadler, an Eagle River Republican who caucuses with the minority.
Is there a problem? I think that we all acknowledge there is. Is this a solution? I think it is. Is it the perfect solution? No, it's not. But we don't deal in perfect and ideal. We do what's best and what we can do.
The bill now heads to the state Senate, which passed a similar bill in 2024. In other news, daily halibut catch limits for unguided recreational fishermen in Alaska will remain the same this year as last year. That's after the International Pacific Halibut Commission took no action on a proposal that would have reduced daily catch limits for those fishermen. The commission received a record number of public comments, 935 ahead of its four-day meeting last month, and most were opposed to the proposal. But the commission decided not to take action on the proposal and instead send a letter to a different regulatory agency asking them to take a deeper look. The proposal, which was submitted by a Seattle-based fishing association, sought to reduce unguided recreational anglers' daily catch limits in Alaska from 2 halibut to 1. The International Commission said at its meeting last month that the unguided sport harvest of halibut in parts of Southeast increased from 900,000 pounds in 2024 to 1.4 million pounds by the end of last year. In its letter to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, the Halibut Commission attributed the increase to the unguided bareboat fishing sector. Since the council deals with more management and allocation concerns, the International Pacific Halibut Commission suggested that the council consider measures to, quote, improve management and catch data collection for the unguided recreational sector, end quote. The council is not required to take any action on this issue, and it's not on the agenda for the council's meeting starting on February 5th. So while the council potentially considers the International Commission's request, daily catch limits for unguided recreational fishermen in Alaska remain at 2 halibut per day in South Central Kodiak Island area and 1 per day in Southeast. And our final story for this week, the Kodiak Island Borough School District's Board of Education is waiting at least another week before it decides how it will cover a looming budget deficit for next school year. But as KMXT reports, the board is homing in on its plan. Last week, the board whittled down its list of budget-cutting scenarios from 7 to 3. Board President Kerry Irons said during a work session on Monday that none of the options are good, and 2 of them include closing an elementary school.
We had programmatic cuts without a school closure. We had closed Maine, including some programmatic cuts. And we had closed Peterson, including some programmatic cuts.
Programmatic cuts would impact specialized staff like special education teachers, student support services for mental health, and specific academic programs. According to budget documents, not closing a school and making cuts only would remove more than 30 district staff, such as the human resources director, the auditorium director, and several teachers' aides. Altogether, the proposed cuts total about $3.4 million. Graham Edwards, the non-voting Coast Guard representative on the school board, was one of a few board members who voiced support for this option on Monday night. He says that it would be better in the long run to hold off on closing a school until at least next year.
So there's still ample opportunity to bring programs back. Also cut them, but hopefully bring them back. And with that, like, if we were to close a school, like we were to close Peterson and it goes back to the Coast Guard, it's gone. It's gone forever. It's never going to come back.
Another scenario involves closing Maine Elementary School and making fewer district-wide staff cuts. 200 students in 4th and 5th grades are currently taught at Maine, and the school has roughly 10 support staff, including a principal, a school nurse, and a librarian. Board member Mike Litzo says he favors closing a school rather than relying on programmatic cuts.
I recognize very strongly the allure of the idea of tapping the brakes and trying to get through this year with programmatic cuts. I am concerned, though, that there's potentially a cost to classroom education from doing that. We have $3.3 million closure scenarios for Maine that result in the loss of only 5 teacher positions across the district.
And as for the scenario that closes Peterson Elementary School, board member Duncan Fields wrote a memo ahead of Monday night's work session opposing that school closure. Among the 6 reasons he listed, Fields argued that closing Peterson would reduce education quality for the school's 195 students and send the wrong message to state and national lawmakers. Astrid Rose, a parent of a 2nd and 5th grader in the school district, says the message has already been sent.
Kodiak and all of Alaska is facing enrollment decline and long-term funding challenges. Acting as though we can shield one subset of families from that reality while everyone else bears the burden is neither equitable nor honest.
If the board decides to close an elementary school, the consolidation scenarios involve moving some middle school students into Kodiak High School and changing which grades will be taught in the remaining 2 elementary schools. As of Monday, the board updated their target deficit to $2.7 million instead of the roughly $4.5 million it had identified earlier this year. Fields says that's because more intensive needs students who come with higher state funding were identified, and the district's financial obligation for the closed North Star School is lower than expected. The board did not take final action on next school year's budget. School Board President Irons says the plan is to vote on it next week. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
KMXT is supported in part by the Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center, providing support for victims of domestic and or sexual violence. 907-486-6171.
If you enjoy this podcast, make sure to subscribe to us on Spotify. Our staff put together KMXT stories every week to help you keep up to date on the archipelago's latest news. And that's it for this week's edition of the KMXT Weekly Wrap. Again, I'm Davis Hovey. We'll be back next week, same time, same place. Thanks for tuning in.